I need to check just a little on what you're expecting to get from this workshop, because there are a number of approaches that we can take. Now, does someone know the title of it? Contemporary Communication. Okay. Not that I haven't prepared. I put a lot of preparation in. But I just need to know what it is you're expecting and what it is that you want. Because I think we often, when we talk about contemporary communication, can give some material on how to lead a university professor to Christ. And we're not really involved in that type of ministry. So, what is it? Let's just have some people share what it is they're expecting to get from this session.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could go into a little bit on the problems of communicating the gospel to the person who's involved with some of the mysticism and Eastern religions that are going around today.
Okay.
I always reach a dead end with people like following the Guru Maharaj.
Oh, yeah, same thing.
They act spacey, and they'll say, I have seen God.
Yeah.
Say things that I have no answer to, and it gets to a point where you can't really talk to them, and I always wish that I could.
Okay. Yeah, they've seen things that you'll never see, hopefully, as well. What else?
I think I'd like to have some points of how to talk to them.
Okay, now we're hitting a little more the intellectual thing there. But there seems to be a clear distinction between the Eastern religions and the hippie movement and intellectual problems. Because usually there's nothing very intellectual about the Eastern religions or the hippie movement. Yeah?
I play a lot of tennis with psychology.
Okay. I've got a good deal of material on that.
Well, people who are conscious of being cultured black, how can a white relate to a black in your people?
Okay, cross-cultural communication, that's something else. I better jot that one down. Now, what we could point out at this point on cross-cultural communication is that you mentioned white and black, but in this generation, there's also radically different cultures within the white section, like communicating with followers of Guru Maharaji or certain hippies. It's sometimes harder to get on a level of understanding with them than it is with somebody from the Middle East, for instance. Okay, so we need to talk a little about that. Yeah? Okay. We have a good deal of material on that.
How Christianity speaks to the identity crisis.
Okay, we have some on that. Yeah?
More specifically on philosophy, and I'd like to know if you have any thoughts on the current rise in existentialism.
Yeah.
The main difference between Christianity and
Now we can't get into the main difference, but we can talk about some of the principles involved in meeting with Baha'i people, which would be the same as meeting with any other oddball religion. Yeah?
Did he come in contact with the Mormon religion?
Yeah, very unsuccessfully.
How about the thing they've got now called One World Crusade? It's kind of the same deal. They say, well, we believe in the Bible, and then they throw anything out that they don't like.
Okay, that's verging on a different topic, which would be the authority of the scriptures. We may not get to that today. Yeah?
Yeah, a little along the line of what he was saying about psychology, the current real trend is like T-day transactional analysis, and I wonder if he has something to speak to that.
Okay, now how many of you, I know that most of us have done evangelism of different sorts and different amounts, that I know that some yesterday had their first opportunity of sharing with friends about Christ. How many of you are interested in the philosophy approach or in communicating with people who are studying philosophy? I see. There's quite a few, really. Now, how many are interested in the Eastern religions and all that includes? That would also include the hippie movement. Okay, now, is there anything that's not included within those two basic categories? There's that thing on the scriptures.
A Unitarian movement where they're trying to get all the religions together.
Yeah, that comes, that's, okay. Yeah, that's something that we've been involved with and had fun with. Okay, that would be included in the hippie Eastern religion thing, by and large. How much time do we have? We have to 12:30, good. Because, you know, this is a fantastic amount of material to get into. And I'm not sure how we can handle this so much as a workshop, which involves you. I don't really think that in this type of subject it's possible to have the workshop where you guys do a lot of preparation. And the only preparation that we can talk about is the life preparation and the things that you've been involved with over the last few years. And so we're almost certainly going to be touching on material that that won't be of interest to all of you. Probably right the way through, we're going to be talking about material that only is of limited interest to everybody here. But I hope that as we go through, there'll be something for everybody. I'd like to... by way of preliminary to just talk about this question of answers. I remember many years ago I wanted an answer for all of the questions that I was asked. When I was growing up as a Christian, the main thing was science and Christianity. Well, that's not quite such an important issue today. It's a little bit different. And I wanted answers to the questions that supposedly scientists put forward. And I wanted it for two reasons. One was because of my own insecurity, that I needed to know the answers for my own satisfaction and just for my own intellectual integrity. And I think that would apply to each of us, that we need to know these answers not only for the sake of communication, but for the sake of our own understanding, so that we can feel there is an answer that satisfies me, even if I can't communicate it too well to someone else. And then the second thing, we need answers for our own integrity, not only for evangelism. I would say that's the foundational thing, that we need these answers, unless there are going to be these little sneaky doubts at the back of our minds. And for years I had little sneaky doubts at the back of my mind. And then the second thing is this, that as we come up with some answers, what do we visualize? That here we are in a situation with a couple of Krishna guys or philosophy majors, and then by the unshakable logic and brilliance of our answers to bring them to their knees in repentance and faith. Probably you wouldn't put it like that quite, and yet at the back of your mind that's what you want. That you want these answers which are unshakable in their brilliance and logic, which will bring them staggering to their knees in repentance. Well, that won't happen. That's not what answers accomplish. It's more in the pre-evangelism. I don't like that term, but in dealing with somebody's intellectual problems, we bring them to the point where we can share the bridge with them. You know, where the real basic evangelism can now take place. And so when we bring them to that point, they still have all the problems that somebody, you know, that a kid brought up in a Christian family who doesn't have too many problems but hasn't yet received Christ, they're still in that sort of situation. There's the problem with their wills. They don't want to give up their right to their own lives. There's the problem with our lifestyle. They don't want to change in order to live as a Christian should. And so answers don't bring people to Christ. They strip away some of the excuses, and they lay bare some of the barriers that people have built up around them to protect them from Christ. But even when that is done, there's still a long way to go. Now, we're still not getting into it yet. That's the second thing. The first thing is, we need the answers for our own sake. The second thing is that answers don't bring people to Christ necessarily. They just bring them to that point where where the rest of us are, where we have that confrontation of our will with the will of Christ, and either we submit to him or we turn away. That's the second thing. And now, what on earth was the third thing? There were three. Yes, the third thing is that that this is something that takes years to become familiar with and years to become skilled in the usage of. That in a session like this, or even in several sessions like this, you're still not going to find it very easy or feel very much at home when you're talking with a Baha'i or a Krishna or from some of the more recent religions. That's still going to be difficult. But we need to be involved in a process of self-education, of learning, and of understanding until we reach the point where we can have an enjoyable discussion with these people. So we're talking about something that's going to take years to accomplish in your lives and will only be accomplished if you apply yourself to it. Quite deliberately, for 2 or 3 years, I applied my mind to finding answers. Well, I'm not doing that now. I'm applying my mind to something else. And, you know, through the process of life, unless you want to drift, you have to, on some of these basic things, say, now I'm going to spend the next couple of years, and my basic reading is going to be in the area of dealing with philosophical questions. And preferably you would do that after you graduate. Then, as you cope with that, you'd say, well, now I'm going to spend 2 or 3 years reading about missions. Or after that, I'm going to spend 6 months reading about anthropology. You know, there's a process of growth through life which equips us to deal with people. And so as we're talking of dealing with our contemporaries, there has to be a process of growth that equips us to deal with them. And that was the third point that I wanted to introduce by way of introduction to this whole deal. Now, there are some things that apply to any form of evangelism that that we have to be doing, or we're not going to be very successful. There's a unique setting in the United States where there are generations of people who've been brought up with a Christian background and with some exposure to the Bible, and we can meet them for the first time in a dormitory, share the bridge with them, and they receive Christ genuinely. All that they've needed is to know how to take that step of faith. But that's very rare, and it's becoming, at least in my experience in the West here in Colorado and California, is becoming less common, that we're meeting less people of that sort than we did, say, 5 years ago. And my guess is that 5 years from now it'll be even less. So we do need to learn how to communicate with people who don't have a Christian background. And we need to still be reaping, of course, as we meet people who do. In England, we have a situation where perhaps 2 or 3% of the population go to church, and very few of those churches would be fundamental or evangelical. So the proportion of people who grow up with a knowledge of Scripture or of all the basic things concerning Christ are very few. And in evangelism there, sometimes we meet them, but more often we don't. And I remember the first guy who came to Christ in Southampton when I began there was a guy called Greg Serple. And he had no unusual hassles. He just had never been exposed to it before. And I was the first guy he met that had ever taken Christianity seriously. And we became good friends. And after a while, we began meeting 4 or 5 nights a week. On Tuesday night, he'd come around for dinner, and we'd spend the whole evening from about 6 to midnight together. Then 2 or 3 other evenings of the week, we'd get together between 10:30 and midnight. And this continued month after month. I reached the point, what else is there to communicate to this guy? And I remember we met, was it September? And in January or February, I met him in the Union one day, and he told me he'd received Christ. And yet there was no great difference. And of course there wasn't, because he'd been exposed to the Scriptures now and to my life for months. He'd been in the Word with me, he'd done certain studies with me, and so his conversion was a very untraumatic thing. He received Christ and just continued. And over that year, there were about 5 other guys who came the same way, averaging between 3 or 4 months and 18 months each of constant exposure. And then I came here for a few years and got a little bit away from that type of evangelism until I went to Canada last November. And that was a shock because it was like being back in England. And I was involved in evangelism. The Navigators asked me to go there in four different campuses. And I had the opportunity to teach some philosophy classes and other classes there and to answer questions and to have my wits sharpened again where evangelism was concerned. But the thing is, we're getting more and more into that here. I recognize that at CU, just 30 miles north of here, we're more and more meeting people who have some very difficult questions. And each summer, we're meeting tens of thousands of people from the hippie scene. Boulder has the largest drug sales and consumption of any city in the United States. A city of 70,000 consumes more drugs than San Francisco. You can't walk through the campus, you can't walk over a field. Well, I guess you can, but quite often as you're walking over a field or through a dormitory and your nose is sensitive to certain aromas, you know what's happening. So we're getting into this sort of deal where we have to know how to deal with different people, and evangelism is becoming harder. We've often heard that relationships are important. And I want to stress that in the type of evangelism we're talking about, relationships are super important. For two summers, we had became infamous in Navigator circles, the Boulder hippie program. Was anybody here ever involved in that? Summer of 70 and 71, where we rented a fraternity on the hill for the 10 weeks of the summer. And this was the deal, that we had about 40 of the Nav gang there, and we each had a room. And we'd go out on the hill, which was the area where the hippies congregated and where the drugs were sold. And the objective was that each person would make friends with a hippie and invite him or her to come and live with us. And so each guy had a room with one bed in it. So they would invite one of these street guys to come in and live with them. And they'd throw the mattress on the floor, and they'd share their room with this hippie. And the deal was this, that they could stay with us for 3 days without any demands being made upon them. But if they wanted to stay after that, they had to get into a little Bible study in the mornings. It just lasted an hour. And if they got into that, there were no other demands made, and they could live with us all summer, be fed and looked after. And we did this for two summers. And learned a fantastic amount about communicating with that type of person. Because how do you communicate with somebody whose mind is so blown that he can't put two words together logically? The first guy I ever met in Boulder had a beard down to his navel and hair down to his waist. And I sat down beside him, and communication was impossible because his mind was so shattered. And I thought, are they all like this? And I almost wanted to get a plane back to England. But then during the summers, we were exposed 100% almost to that type of person. How do you communicate across that type of barrier? Well, then again, people would come to live with us whose minds certainly were not blown, but were so far removed from all Central American culture that it was like dealing with somebody from Outer Mongolia. Just their thinking patterns were so different. And then people from the different religious groups would come and live with us. And this would continue all summer. Usually there'd be about 40 guests, sometimes it'd be 70. And can you imagine it? 10 weeks without a minute of privacy, because they're in your room with you. If you have a quiet time, they're there with you. Anyway, this is what happened, that at the end of each summer, there were about 28 or 30 who came to Christ. And as we spent some time afterwards evaluating why these people came to Christ and hearing from them, of course, why they came to Christ, the overwhelming reason was this, that it wasn't because of what you said to us. It was because of what we observed. You know, we would have big raps on existentialism, dealing with philosophical problems, and, you know, there'd be argument, questioning, all sorts of things would happen. One night we had a guy die who'd taken too many drugs. Or you'd go downstairs to the basement and you'd find how about this one? There were a guy and a girl in a sleeping bag together. And it wasn't me. It would have been a lovely experience. One of our guys went in, and there they were in the sleeping bag together, and she quickly picked up a living Bible like this and began looking at it. And she said, "We're in here to keep warm so as we can read the Bible." So there were all sorts of fun experiences and tragic ones. And we would have different raps with individuals. We'd sit out late at night. It was summer. And the summer went by. But the reason why they came to Christ was because they observed our lifestyle. And then, as the follow-up continued, we rented the top floor of another fraternity, moved some Christian guys in, and moved the converted hippie gang in. And the follow-up, of course, of people in that situation is desperate. I remember one couple that my wife and I were involved with, whose first application from Bible study was to stop beating his wife on a daily basis. And she would be black and blue, and come round to see Vicky, and their minds were half blown, and just time-consuming and energy-consuming and tragic. Then I remember one year we had about 16 hippies live in our home, and that wiped us out, and we were never able to do that again. The point is this: you cannot communicate to that type of person, and you cannot be effectively involved in their lives unless you're prepared to pay an almost overwhelming price. And my guess is very few of you are. And I keep wondering, am I? And maybe I'm not, because you get so much easier results in different places and with different people. And the ministry to a hippie community and to an Eastern religion community is a very specialized one. Ideally, it's one for single people. And yet you also need homes and families. The living situation is the answer. There has to be the ability to communicate and to discuss things with them, but the living situation as the reality of Christ is communicated unconsciously was the thing that led to converts. There was one girl who walked by the fraternity, and she came in, and I asked her why she came in, and she didn't know what was there. She said, "I was just walking by and the vibes were so good that I came in." You know, just something almost electric seemed to emanate from the house, so that even passers-by, without hearing a word, could sort of feel it and come in. And they were two very exciting summers. But I found that I've never been able to communicate effectively to people of that type without that sort of situation. And I honestly don't know how you can, unless you're prepared to live with them. Now, let me be, is that a hopeless thing to say? Or does it suggest that it's a special ministry? Maybe it does. There were people out of both summers who are now involved in the mainstream of Navigator activity in different campuses around the country, so it was fruitful. But the actual process of evangelism, I'm beginning to question if it can be done as part of a normal area ministry. And the situation that I would like to have in Boulder, if we were staying, would have been for me to direct the overall ministry, and for us to have a couple in, maybe a younger staff couple, to head up. We talked about this a couple of years ago, and I remember spending an hour or two with Lon Sanny downstairs in the King James talking about it, because he was interested in that type of ministry we were having. And yet somehow that never worked out. I guess no couple was available. But to have a couple who would be available full-time to minister to no one else, and then to have some single men and girls who would also be involved in that ministry. I think you could have both in the same area if you had some people who only did that. Is there any reaction to what I've said? Has that come across as too negative? Or
do you have any better results that say some of the people that come to Christ say as a hippie or as formerly a hippie or Eastern religionist, when they come back, say to the people that they knew before, is the same sort of extended commitment required of them, or are they better adept, say, at communicating to those people and say, you or I would...
Oh, yes. Definitely. They're better adept to it.
Do you think perhaps might be a ministry that might perhaps be more successfully accomplished through, say, a group of these type of people?
That's an excellent question, because I believe the answer to that is no. That they need something that they don't have that we can bring, and that's stability. That the average hippie is so footloose that he meets any problem, his first difficulty in discipleship, and he packs his bag and takes off. Maybe you see him again 6 months later. But one thing that you notice in the Jesus movement generally is a lack of stability, a lack of depth in the word, and a lack of that, not so much of commitment, but of perseverance. And I think that's something that we can bring to it. And that in a navigated environment, we can have the hippie thing, you know, over here, and the regular collegiate thing here, and mixing together. We used to mix them together all the time. Then that adds that stability. So I think it's good if we, with our middle class background, can be involved in that. But I think you also need somebody who's involved with it up to their neck and over. So we can bring stability to that, and depth in the word and direction. But the best evangelists probably will be those people who've come out of it.
Yeah. In other words, what you're saying basically is you're hoping that through, you know, like those other hippies that come to Christ, you know, through the nap, either ministry or whatever, perhaps maybe by good follow-up, maybe they can get the depth in the word,
yeah,
the spiritual strength to go back and minister to people like them.
Yeah, it's a much freer kind of follow-up. You know, it's it's a lot of fun and a lot more free and easy. Yeah.
I'm totally disoriented as far as hippies are concerned. Can you give us any hippie history?
Well, let's give something better than that. Let's give how you can get it.
Where do they come from?
Yeah, let's get into that. That in both of our programs, we had people like myself originally who had no experience or background with it. So, and this will apply to the Eastern religious things. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had a festival of consciousness at Boulder, where everything was there. It covered several acres, from the familiar Krishnas to this new Arika religion, the tarot. There was a little tarot demonstration, and the astrologers were there, and there were probably 30 or 40 different religious groups. And we were the only Christian one represented. So we had a gang. Many of them had never been exposed to these things before because I drew them from our summer program in Denver. We've done this a number of times at this type of festival. And the objective we give them is to learn that you're not going there primarily to witness, though, because with an Afghan that's inevitable. They're going there to learn, and therefore they pick off a guy or a couple of guys, Krishna, maybe one of this new religion, this Arika one, or one of Maharaji's followers, or you name them, and sit down with that guy, have some vegetable juice with him or whatever he drinks, and ask questions. And that's the only way you can do it, is not to immediately start witnessing to him, but to ask him how he got involved in the group, what he was doing previously, why he became a member of it, what needs it fulfills in his life, what his concept of God is. That's an interesting one. What his concept of heaven is. That also is very interesting. Often very tragic. And just by continually asking questions, instead of, as he makes a reply, instead of turning that into a witnessing opportunity, turn it into a question where you'll find out more about who he is, and why he's there, and what he's in it for. And often if you can get to one of these festivals, like the Festival of Consciousness, or what was the one that we were at just before that? I've forgotten. They want to talk, and we want to talk. So if we go as learners, we'll learn. And then after maybe an hour or two, then perhaps is the opportunity to talk about Christ. Because we haven't the basis, and in many ways it's rather presumptuous to go in headfirst talking about Jesus until we've found out a little about the guy himself. And I think instead of giving any of the answers that I've come up with through asking these questions, it would be best for you to go and ask the questions. There are some things you should be cautious of, and those are the you'll run into a lot of Satanism, and some things are almost satanic in their just in their very form. But that's part of the risk that we have to take, and therefore we have to be walking with God and enjoying His presence. This, I was scared talking to a couple of guys just a week or two ago, and I felt encompassed by evil. And we had some younger people there as well, and I just began praying for them that God would protect them. And yet somehow I don't feel that we should protect ourselves by evasion. You know, this is the world, and we should be in it. But by communication and questions are the answers. Just question them, question them, question them.
Do you think there are some groups of people that you, this is not going to sound right, but I'll go ahead and say it and I'll explain myself, that you should not approach, for instance, the Satan worshippers? There are a lot of people I know who have gotten, you know, just had an interest in them, and they got so involved that they... that were Christians, you know, before they started, they got so involved that it just got all out of proportion.
Yes.
Do you think there are some people that you just should not approach?
I would put it the other way around and say there are some Christians who are not ready to get involved. It's not something to do lightly, and it's not something to do by yourself. You know, if you do it by yourself, you're asking for trouble, you know?
What do Satan worshippers?
Oh. Yeah. Well, it's so varied. It could be the tarot cards, or any of the methods of communicating with the dead. That's usually satanic. Yeah, anything of that sort is usually satanic.
Do they have one national organization now?
I don't believe so. Yeah. Or even people in the Jesus movement I've met who've been satanically oppressed, if not possessed. And this is scary. You know, if you read the Gospels and look at Romans 1, we find that the situation we're getting into is not a new situation, but it's one which was prevalent when Jesus was completing his ministry and when Paul was doing his. That we're returning to a situation, not getting into a new one. Does everybody have this first sheet? We're just one short. We're only three or four short. Well, I'm sure that you can do some sharing, and if anybody wants a copy, they can get them copied now. Okay, if you can just manage to share, that'll be great. I want to look at Romans 1, because I believe that in Romans 1 we can lay a foundation for our evangelism to many different types of people. And we're not going to look at all of Romans 1, but just that which is pertinent to what we're talking about. In order for you to see the overall picture, maybe it would be helpful to understand the thrust of the argument of the letter to the Romans. We can do that very briefly. That in chapter 1, well, chapter 1:18 to 3:20, Paul does one thing, and with a masterly argument, he comes to the conclusion at the end of 3:20 that the whole world is accountable to God. That's his conclusion at the end of the first section of Romans. And in chapter 1, he shows that the pagan world, and by the pagan world, he means that part of the community which don't have the scriptures available to them, under the just condemnation of God. Then he goes into some principles of judgment. Then in the last part of chapter 2 and the first part of chapter 3, he shows how that the Jewish world, that would be that part of the community who have the scriptures, that they too are under the righteous condemnation of God. So he comes to his conclusion at the end of 3:19 and 20, that the whole world is under the righteous condemnation of God. Then 3:21 to 8:39, he shows how a man can become righteous, beginning with justification and continuing through sanctification. So as we get into Romans 1 now, we're right at the beginning of the argument, and Paul is showing how men without the scriptures, under the just and righteous condemnation of God. Now verses 16 and 17 are by way of introduction to the whole book, and they are very important for us as we think of communicating the gospel. For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. That's Paul's statement at the beginning of Romans. Philip's translation is excellent. He says, I see the gospel as God's plan for imparting righteousness to men, a process begun and continued by their faith. Men become righteous through faith initially, and they become righteous in the quality of their lives by faith as time goes by. But I want to zero in now on that first statement, for I am not ashamed of the gospel. Today's English version translates that, this is a negative statement, today's English version changes it around to a positive statement. I have complete confidence in the gospel. I have complete confidence in the gospel. Or, probably more accurately, I am not ashamed of the gospel. Now, what does it mean either to have complete confidence in the gospel or not to be ashamed of it? Well, if there was a single life situation, a single personal need that anybody could have that could not be met through the gospel, then we would have cause to be ashamed of that. If there was a question which could not be answered relating to God and our relationship with him, then we would have cause to be ashamed of the gospel. If there was a psychological or emotional need that a person might have, and the answer was not in the gospel, then we would have cause to be ashamed of the gospel. Are you with me? That unless every need that every human being who has ever lived can be met through the scriptures, then we have cause to be ashamed. Now the reason why Paul said, I am not ashamed of the gospel, is that he knew without any doubt that every need that every person in the whole world had or would ever have could be met through the simple truth of Jesus Christ. Now, that's easy to say, and it's harder to be convinced of. Whenever we take a Christian to the psychiatrist, we indicate that we're ashamed of the gospel. I guess we don't do too much of that. But whenever somebody asks a question that we feel cannot be answered from the scriptures, then we're ashamed of the gospel. Or, to put it rather differently, if we don't like to be seen walking around with a Bible in our hands, we're ashamed of the gospel. But Paul could make this statement knowing that every need could be met, every question could be answered through the scriptures. That's the foundation of this letter, and is the foundation of the Christian life, and is certainly the foundation of all evangelism. Because if we're ashamed of the gospel, we're going to be rather poor in communicating it. Now, you see that there's a little outline here for chapter 118 to the end of chapter 1 called Pagan Guilt. And in this section, Paul is coming to the conclusion that everybody, even those people who don't have the scriptures, and therefore who don't have the direct propositional revelation of God through his word, are guilty, nevertheless, before him. And let's see how he does that, because in it we're going to find some essential truths for our evangelism. Verses 18 to 20 tell us that God has revealed his truth to everybody. then verses 21 to 23 show that all men, without exception, have rejected that truth. And then verses 24 to 32 show the inevitable consequences of their rejection. God's wrath comes upon them. Verse 18 is a summary of that whole process. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men, who by their wickedness suppress the truth. Now I want to zero in now on verses 19 and 20. Verse 19, for what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it within them. Then verse 20, ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. Now let's look at verse 19 again, and you probably have a number of different versions in front of you. Who has the New American Standard? I guess quite a few do. Who have King Jimmy? Quite a few again. Who has the RSV? Yeah, that's good variety. Well, let's look at verse 19. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it. Now, I want to comment on this next word, because God has shown it to them. The RSV has. The New American Standard, more correctly, has God has shown it within them. And you'll notice on the sheet in front of you, New American Standard has is evident within them. William's translation has is clear to their inner moral sense. And many of the latest translations don't have that little word too, but have it as has been suggested by those two other quotations. So if we read it using, say, Williams, we'd come up with this. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it clear to their inner moral sense. So verse 19 tells us that there's something within every man that bears witness to the fact of God. There are other scriptures which indicate this. Ecclesiastes 3:10 is very good. It says that God has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into the mind of man. Also, he has put eternity into the mind of man. That God has put something into man's mind that cannot be satisfied with anything less than eternity. God has put eternity into the mind of man. Or John, is it John 1:19 or John 1:9? Maybe that's a misquote. The true light that enlightens every man was coming into the world, referring to Christ. And that indicates that there is a sense in which Christ has enlightened every man who has ever lived. It's John 1:9. That's not accurate. The true light that enlightens every man was coming into the world. So there we have three scriptures, Ecclesiastes 3:10, John 1:9, Romans 1:19, which suggests that God has revealed himself within every person. And in a moment, we'll hit on how he's done that. Now the next verse, verse 20, you need to change that on your little deal. It's got verse 19 again. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. So God has revealed himself in two ways. He's revealed himself in three. He's revealed himself through his word, through the scriptures, through Christ. But that's only available to people who've heard of Christ and who have the scriptures. But these two ways are true of everybody who's ever lived. God has revealed himself through something that goes on in the inner workings of a man's heart and mind. Verse 19. And God has revealed himself externally through the universe, verse 20. Now this is a foundational truth for evangelism. And we're going to be spending a good deal of time this morning talking about the implications of verse 19. Now let's look at verses 21 to 23. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. And then the rest of the chapter shows the inevitable results of deliberate atheism. But let's comment a little on verses 21 to 23, particularly on verse 22. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. And I'd like to read a comment that that Schaeffer makes on this verse. When the scripture speaks of men being thus foolish, it does not mean that he is only religiously foolish. Rather, it means that he has accepted a position that is intellectually foolish, not only to what the Bible says, but also in regard to what exists. The universe and its form, that would be verse 20, the universe and its form, and the mannishness of man, that would be verse 19. In turning away from God and the truth which he has given, man has thus become foolishly foolish in regard to what man is and what the universe is. He is left with a position in which he cannot live, and he is caught in a multitude of intellectual and personal tensions. Now this is very important. We know that verse 19 and 20 are true of everybody that has ever lived. God has revealed himself, as verse 19 says, to their inner moral sense. He's revealed something within them. Verse 20, God has revealed himself through the universe. And so when men reject that knowledge of God, limited though it might be, they become foolish. And in becoming foolish, they're caught in a multitude of intellectual and personal tensions. Now that's important, because in our evangelism, we need to be able to put our finger on some of those intellectual and personal tensions. We need to be able to do that in order to help people recognize these tensions, and in recognizing them, to enable us to point them in the direction of Jesus. So we're talking now about the philosophy class. Not only the philosophy class, we're talking about Joe Soap, who has never heard the word philosophy. It's true of him as well. Verses 19 and 20 are true of everybody who has ever lived. The philosophy professor, the biology professor, the zoology professor, the guys who give the hassles, and also the guys who've never done too much thinking. That they're caught in a multitude of intellectual and personal tensions because they've rejected the light that God has given them within their own hearts and externally through the universe. Now, let's go back to how God has revealed himself in these ways. Let's talk about verse 21st, because I don't want to go into that in too great detail. I want to spend more time on verse 19. God has revealed himself externally, and Psalm 19, verses 1 to 6, illustrate that. We often sing the last part of Psalm 19. It's a beautiful psalm, because the first part of it indicates how God has revealed himself through nature, and the second part reveals how God has revealed himself through his word. We need both, but God has revealed himself through nature. And we must take pains not to reject that revelation. Paul speaks that through nature we can come to recognize the eternal power and deity of God. That nature bears evidence of an unseen creator. And we could go into that. The very all fact of design in nature, of being, of order, of... or just, I think the very distance of the universe speaks of the eternity of God. There could be no beginning to it, there could be no end to it. There could be no beginning to time, there could be no end to time, there could be no beginning to distance, there could be no end to distance. You know, they all bear witness to an eternal and powerful creator. But now let's look at verse 19 and spend the rest of our time on that. And as we do that, I would like you to have the other four pages in your hands. If the guys who have them could hand them out. They're numbered pages 2 to 5, I think. Okay. We haven't finished with the first page yet, and we need to look at that just for a moment on this matter of presuppositions. Now, everybody has presuppositions, whether they know it or not. Most people don't know it. But nevertheless, they do have presuppositions. And presupposition which most characterizes this generation is the one at the bottom of page one. That's the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system. And this would be, let's talk about that just for a little. The uniformity of natural causes, what does that mean? It means that when you drop a stone, it drops at 32 feet per second today. It'll also drop at 32 feet per second next week. That there's a reliability and a consistency about the way things happen in nature. That things always happen the same way. And unless they did, there could be no science. Because if water boiled at one temperature today and another one tomorrow, there'd be no way in which knowledge could be collated and stored and used. So we do live in a world that is consistent. There is a uniformity of natural cause. That there's a uniformity of cause and effect. That if we hit something with a certain amount of power, then that's projected with an equal and opposite amount of power. That that things happen in a uniform way. Now, the reason for this, and this is a little bit of a tangent, is because God is uniform, that God is faithful. And the very recognition of the faithfulness and uniformity of God was what led to the development of modern science back in the 17th century as the Reformation and Renaissance, as people got back into the scriptures, they recognized that God was consistent. And therefore, because God was consistent, the universe was consistent. That there was a uniformity, that there were laws which governed the movement of the earth around the sun. There were laws which governed the speed at which something would fall. There were laws which governed all natural events. And because they recognized that God is uniform and recognized this, a modern science began. And the early generation of scientists, men like Newton and Galileo, were men who believed in Christ. No science has ever developed in the East, because in the East they've had no concept of a faithful and uniform God. It was only possible for a science to develop in the West, where the faithfulness of God led to the belief of a uniformity of natural causes. But in our generation, and of course over the last 150 years, people have got away from the foundation of modern science and have ended up with the statement, the uniformity of natural causes, and then they've tagged this other thing on, in a closed system. And that means that nothing can act into the system, that everything happens because of a certain cause, and nothing can alter that. In other words, it's like drawing a circle and saying, now this is the whole show. Everything that happens in that circle happens because of certain factors that take place only within that circle. Nothing can act into the circle to change any part of it. So the closed system means that God, if he exists, cannot act into it. And I gave an example there that should have followed the definition of Matthew Arnold, whose reason for not believing in the virgin birth of Christ was that it was a miracle, and miracles do not happen. His presupposition was that miracles do not happen. And therefore, whatever evidence he was given, he would not believe in the virgin birth of Christ. And so the presupposition that controls and molds the thinking of scientists and philosophers in our day is the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system, whether they've spelt it out like that or not. And it would also be the philosophy which controls the thinking of the average university student. Now, he might not know that. He doesn't have to know it. But it is the thing that controls his thinking. That things happen in a uniform manner. They always have happened in a uniform manner. And nothing can act in to change that.
That's a presupposition. In science, they presuppose there are no miracles. But also, there are things that are unanswered in science. So they make two presuppositions. One is that it someday will be able to be answered.
Yes. Yes. That's based on the uniformity of natural causes, however, that because things are uniform, there will be an answer that will fit this unknown fact into the already known facts. That's true. So this was the presupposition of evolutionary philosophy, and still is, that when things began to happen way back, they began to happen with an inevitable cause and effect. As men, as living matter began to develop, to become more complicated, and eventually to give rise to man himself.
Well, when you're speaking of some kind of perfect truth, you know, that just in existence. Doesn't that kind of presuppose a perfect purity? Because if there was some imperfection.
The very point, you know, is what basis do they have for that presupposition? It can be proved only so far. But there comes a point where you take that by faith.
Yeah, well, see, even without faith, you know, if there's perfect truth, there must be perfect purity. And there's only one means to be, whether you're a Christian or not. Right? There must be some significance to the fact that even to the non-Christian, that there's an underlying purity in the way things work. You know? And so it would seem like that would affect your attitude a great deal.
What do you mean by purity?
Well, like, if creation is a perfect truth, then whatever created it through scientific or mystical means must have been perfect to create a perfect creation. See, so if creation is perfect, you know, kind of, you see what I'm trying to get at? It's kind of a circle.
Except we're talking of a creation that happened accidentally, and of a humanity that developed by accident. That it just happened. There's no reason for it. It happened by chance. It could just as easily not have happened. But the right circumstances came into being so many millennia ago that gave rise to life of a primitive sort, which over succeeding countless millennia has given rise to man. But man himself is only just the progression of from a much more primitive source.
But like so many people, you know, today, no longer very into like cognitive psychology. They no longer it's just typical of like behavioralism, you know, where the environment shaped the product.
Right.
So how can both exist at the same time?
How can the environment shape the product, and what's the other?
And have the innate knowledge within man exist?
Well, that's the question. That's contradictory.
Yeah, what I'm asking is, what's the answer that's given?
There is no answer that can be given. Many answers have been tried, but no satisfactory answer has ever been given.
I'm just trying to draw on your experience.
Yeah, well, that's true. There is no answer. However widely you read on, as men have tried to answer this, they have failed so abysmally. If you read Julian Huxley, that as he talks about the physical development of man, maybe he's right, but as he gets to talk about human nature, he ends up in a blind alley. There's no way out, and he has no answers, and he knows it. So he's caught in a multitude of tensions. The same with Gaylord Simpson. Or as soon as they begin to talk about man as he is, there's no answer. Let's, how does this thing go on? There it is. The uniformity of natural causes in a closed system, giving rise through... we don't have to know too much about... one of the things that's always bugged me about Christians, when they talk about evolution, is they talk maybe to a guy who spent 30 years studying it, and they've spent an hour or two reading an article in Christianity Today on how evolution didn't occur, and try to discuss on an equal footing with him. Well, that's impossible. It's presumptuous. There's no basis for it. How do we know evolution didn't happen? Well, we don't know. And even if we did, if we had that conviction it didn't happen, we could discuss with Julian Huxley or whoever from now until doomsday and get no nearer sharing the gospel with him. So it's best, I believe, to just make that assumption that if evolution occurred, as they say it did, let's not argue it. And you save a whole pile of useless hassles. See, the evolutionary philosophy underlies, even though it doesn't always come to the surface, all of the philosophical questions that we face in the classroom. Now, this is the circle of the uniformity of natural causes with no influence from outside. So here we've ended up with you or with me. And often, at least in my experience over the years, the best approach has been to assume that it occurred the way they say it did. Just not argue it. We don't have the basis for arguing it. If maybe you'd had 30 years studying biology and psychology, then maybe you would. But unless you've had that, it's sort of presumptuous. And we come across as cocky kids when we do. So if we assume it, that it did happen, we can say this, that if evolutionists with their presupposition have given an accurate picture of how man occurred physically, they've been quite unable to give an accurate picture of what has led to the development of human nature. And you'll notice there's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 down there on the page in front of you. That could maybe be more or greater things. We'll pull this together a little better in a minute, then I think you'll see where we're going. Personality, value. Can you read this? No? Okay, well, I'll read it out. I guess some of you can read it. I can from here. There could be, those six are chosen at random. There could be fewer, there could be more. And what I've written down in order are personality, then the value of man, you know, what is my significance, who am I, reason, morality, meaning, and freedom. They've been totally unable to describe the process by which human nature has developed, human nature as we know it. And there are several quotations down here that will develop that thought. I have a book of them here from various things that I've read, and I've chosen just a few of them to put on the pages in front of you. Now, we've made the assumption that 30 years, perhaps, studying philosophy or biology or anthropology, then we need to talk from our position of strength, which is not his, and we need to address ourselves to his position of weakness. And I found that the best way to do that, and I have recent experience in Canada in teaching several classes, was to assume it. You draw their fangs because they feel you're going to argue it, and then when you don't, you're on a firm footing to begin with. Now, I'm not saying it did happen. If it's a fundamental tenet of your faith that Genesis 1 is literal to minute detail, then I'm not concerned to disturb that. All I'm saying is that in talking and in evangelism, we don't need to press that point in order to be effective evangelists. Because we can talk about Genesis 1 and about evolution till our dying day and still not get to the gospel. When we talk about these things, we're presenting the gospel as we do it. And we're talking about the things that Paul speaks of in Romans 1:19, that are referred to in Ecclesiastes 3:10 or John 1:9. Which we know to be true. Yeah?
I have a question concerning the gap there. I know that whenever I'm trying to witness and I take the initiative, I never bring up the subject of evolution.
No.
But occasionally, the other person will bring up the subject of evolution. And from what I've, my limited reading, from what I've seen, the effort is to show that, I'm not sure this is what I'm doing, the effort, the reason they bring it up is to show that man is extremely progressive. Now, perhaps you don't have to argue against evolution to show that man isn't.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So, now, is that how you bridge the gap as far as saying, well, I'm not going to argue with you about it?
Yeah.
What exactly, why did you bring it up in the first place?
You said the evolutionists are trying to establish the fact that man is progressing, and you're saying what?
I'm saying that perhaps you don't have to argue against evolution per se to prove that man isn't progressing.
Right, we don't. Yeah, that's right. We don't have to argue against evolution. If we do, it carries on forever without ever coming to any conclusion. The reason that I've mentioned it now is that we can deal with all of this without ever talking about evolution. But when we're taught, this just puts it in its perspective. Usually we don't talk about evolution when we talk about these things over the side. But if we do talk about evolution, we don't need to alter our approach. Well, was there another question over here or comment?
Yeah. With the discussion, you know, Saturday on the 6 seconds on the right, I can see how you'd say that we wouldn't really have to talk about evolution. But I think you have to deal with their evolutionary assumption. That is, I think you have to deal with their assumption that man is getting better and better as time goes on. And just to, if you don't address this question in your presentation of the gospel, then the gospel is disadvantaged.
Yeah, that comes under morality, number 4, which deals with pain and with the sin of man. Because we're talking here of the contradictions of the evolutionary philosophy. We're not talking about the contradictions of evolution. We're talking about the contradictory nature of the evolutionary philosophy. And these 6 hit most of them. There's 1 or 2 that are not there. Yeah?
This may seem a little literary, but I don't understand how, on the one hand, you can say that scientists have yet to explain, well, they possibly have explained physical development. They have yet to explain the development of human nature. And you can say that on the one hand. On the other hand, you can say we don't need to prove that man's not developing. I don't see.
Why do you think man isn't?
I'm not with you. I mean, man is developing.
Yeah, so...
But morally, he's not developing.
So you're speaking just morality, that's what you're saying?
I thought that's what we were talking about then. Intellectually, men are developing.
Yeah, okay.
So, there are 6 areas here that we need to find out about them. And what they have to say, and how these can be useful in evangelism. And basically all I've given you here are some quotations. Let's have a look at some of them. We didn't pick all of them. And before we do that, we need to be fellows and girls who do read. Because unless we're reading and finding out about things, we're not going to be good at dealing with questions. And as we read, we can begin to fit things into certain pigeonholes of knowledge. Now, that little illustration under the dotted line is one that, from memory, I took from one of Schaeffer's books. And my title for the section was Taking the Roof Off, that a man lives with his presuppositions. And in taking the roof off, we're attempting to show him that he cannot live with those presuppositions and, in fact, is not living according to those presuppositions. That the closer this line, this arrow, you'll notice the man's just a little way along it. If he was living entirely according to his presuppositions, he'd be at the end of the arrow, which almost nobody does. In fact, it's impossible, because a man is made in the image of God and he cannot live according to the presupposition that we've stated of the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system. Now, we want to take the roof off so that a guy can see the impossibility of his position. And we want to take the roof off not only that he'll see the impossibility of his position, but he'll see that the answers can only be found in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, there are a couple of quotations there under personality. And the question is this, that if the universe began by accident, spontaneously and impersonally, you might put down that word impersonal on the little illustration up here where it has spontaneous generation. You might put impersonal beside it or underneath it. But the assumption is that the universe began impersonally by accident. The question is, if that is so, where did personality come from? And there are a couple of quotations there, and that you would need to read far beyond this, but these will show the direction that your answer would take. In the first one, both of these are from Francis Schaeffer. No one has presented an idea, let alone demonstrated it to be feasible, to explain how the impersonal beginning, plus time, plus chance, can give personality. We are distracted by a flourish of endless words. A low personality has appeared out of the hat, and so on. And if you should read books by evolutionists who try to do a thorough job in not only presenting the physical development of man, but also how human nature developed, this is true. But I haven't read very extensively, but what I've read from Huxley and Simpson, there's an endless flourish of words, but there's no answer, and they recognize that. Then the second quotation there, from Genesis in Space and Time, an impersonal beginning explains neither the form of the universe nor the personality of man. The Judeo-Christian tradition begins with the opposite answer, and it is upon this that the whole Western culture has been built. The universe had a personal beginning, a personal beginning on the high order of Trinity. That is, before, in the beginning, the personal was already there. Love and thought and communication existed prior to the creation of the heavens and the earth. So beginning with a personal God in the high order of Trinity, we can not only explain the personality of man, but we can also explain how it is that man communicates. And we can also explain the reality of love, that love is something which transcends the survival of the fittest. And the only answer can be found in creation, however that creation took place, by a personal being on the high order of Trinity. Now, we don't have time to get into that, but that would be that one direction in which dealing with a philosophical problem that you would go, that you might talk about personality and the impossibility of explaining personality on any other basis than that of a God in the high order of Trinity.
Do you divorce the development of morality from the development of personality and all the other?
No, it all happens together, but sometimes you have to separate things just to... And they're arbitrary distinctions. You have to do it just in order to come across.
Well, just for the benefit of me, would you explain how, basically my background, but I still don't understand, if you cannot divorce the development of morality from the other five, then man is progressive. And you can't single out one. You can't say, yeah, he's developing meaning, freedom.
Well, we're not saying he's developing in any of those areas. He's regressing in personality, because in his Adamic state, man's personality and being was very different to that which it is today. He had constant communion with God. He probably... there's a certain amount of conjecture has to go into that. But
say reason.
Yeah?
State reason, you think we're regressing. Or do you equate the ability to reason with intellectual development?
Well, if you're talking about intellectual development, it's hard to see where Adamic man would have gone if he hadn't fallen. Probably a lot further intellectually, because our intellect has also been affected by the fall. But nevertheless, because of the accumulation of experience, we're learning more. If Adam hadn't fallen, he would have gone further quicker. But he would still have to have learnt by experience. He'd have begun by making rather crude clay pots before he ended up with immortal masterpieces. And his mathematical reasoning would have begun with simple beginnings before...
It is a comparative digression.
Well, no, I guess it is in some ways that Adam had the... Adam was put in a situation where he would develop, not in a situation where there he was with everything given to him. Eden was a growing situation. And because we're still made in the character of God and we're still sons of Adam, there is growth. The fall was absolute. That when Adam fell and sin came in, he became a sinner. And whatever form the sin should take, it was of an absolute nature. He was a sinner. And we are sinners. There's no greater sin or lesser sin. There's just sin.
But there's still
not in morality.
Oh, see, then you're divorcing morality from the rest, which we already decided you can't do.
Well, every one of these we have in a limited form. Our freedom has become illusory. Only in relationship to God, with Him as Lord and us as servant, do we have real freedom. But since we've divorced ourselves from God, we have a form of freedom, but it's really a different form of bondage to sin and to our passions. So we're free, but free for what? For sin and passion. It's where it's going to be plugged in. The freedom either is plugged into God, but it's still not freedom in the sense of there being no restraints or no control. It's freedom to fulfill our destiny as His sons. And that was the freedom Adam had. The freedom we have now is the freedom of, very simply, no other, of being sinners and being controlled by our passions.
So what I was looking to is kind of a pseudo-progression.
Yes. Or in meaning. Well, there's been no even apparent progression in meaning. That's meaning is the sore, exposed nerve of our generation. And that's the one that we talk to most of all. Oh, listen, I love talking. Yeah? Well, there's material progression, that's undeniable, but of a far slower and less perfect form than would have been if Adam hadn't fallen. And it's also divorced from reality, that the material progression, what's it for? It's going to collapse into ruins one day. But let's head through a little, and let's not spend too much time on personality, but the question is there. How could an impersonal beginning explain the personality of man? And it cannot. Sure.
According to the Bible, good is not think that survival of the fittest is compatible with God's plan.
I don't want to speak to it because I'm not an expert. See, I don't know. For a while, I've believed different things. I've gone from one pole to another concerning how we came to be where we are. Well, yeah, I believe that that evolution is not incompatible with the scriptures. But I don't want to answer that. You know, I believe that. But answering it would be futile.
What you said a minute ago, that love transcends survival of the fittest. What did you mean?
That if survival is the only basis on which morality has developed, then every decision we take would be on the basis of survival. Now, some people believe that. But if that's true, there could be no such thing as morals. There could be no right or no wrong. Any statement we make would be just the same as I itch or I don't itch, or I like this and I don't like that. But there could be no morality, there would be no such word, there'd be no concept of it. That if survival is the only thing, what leads to survival would be the basis of every decision I take. And that would be the logical conclusion of the evolutionary presupposition. But no man can live that way. Nobody can live as though love does not exist. He may say love doesn't exist, but he goes home and kisses his wife. Or he has a little baby and hugs it. And he knows that that's not just a survival instinct. And therefore love, which by its very nature is sacrificial, transcends the survival of the fittest, because many men have given their lives in a way which doesn't forward the survival of the race, but they've given their lives to the principles. So, yeah?
Well, is it possible to see what I don't understand is when I see it as you presented it, seems like it has to be either or. But I think that's more of the way you presented it, because I can see them both existing at the same time. Like, I think you can easily believe that, like I was talking to you guys earlier, when people love, we love for a reason, and that's because we expect an equal return.
Okay, they could both exist, but what you have to say is that none of the other exists. That none of the that nothing exists that isn't related to survival. Well, if a lot of our love, because our fallen state is related to survival, there is still some which is not, and it's that some which cannot be accounted for.
What is
the sum? Well, it's hard to spell it out, but we know how it is. How we might Christ dying on the cross would be a classic example. Why? Or one man giving his food to another in a prison camp so that he can live, but he'll die. Why?
You said to me, you said that you think that evolution is not a contradiction to what happened. And what I'm seeing, just in line in Genesis, how anybody that believes the Bible can have anything to do with
okay. That's your prerogative, you see. I don't know enough about it to argue. Maybe you're right. Probably you are. But I won't get involved on a discussion on that level because it leads nowhere. And in evangelism, that will not help you to discuss that.
I know it doesn't help evangelism, but just looking at the way what John has said,
Yeah. Okay, it's another question. And we're talking about evangelism now. And I fluctuated on that one. I believe the authority of the scriptures from Genesis 1 through to the end of Revelation. But there are different forms of truth, and truth is expressed in different ways. But I no longer find it profitable to discuss it. Other than with friends, sometimes we go over it again, or I find another book and I read it. Okay, personality, the value of man. You'll see there's a couple of little quotations from my book. I have a lot. There's just a couple there. This one by Jean-Paul Sartre from Communists and Peace is very interesting. All kinds of materialism leads one to treat every man, including oneself, as an object. That is, as a set of predetermined reactions, in no way different from the patterns of qualities and phenomena which constitute a table or a chair or a stone. That's a statement by a man who is an atheist, who sees very clearly the consequences of atheism, that it leads to a complete devaluation of humanity. And then Michael Green's comment at the top, which is a very good one. It's always seemed to me utterly absurd for the atheist to profess such deep regard for the random products of a universe where chance is king. And then a little later, it never surprises me to learn that atheistic humanism is utterly ruthless in torturing and eliminating unwanted persons when it becomes the dominant philosophy in countries that have made a clean break with the Christian tradition. Then the conclusion. If, as some suppose, man is the outcome of a fortuitous concourse of atoms, why on earth should you not manipulate him as you please, provided it is in your power to do so with impunity? And let's not get into that, but let's look now at reason. And Darwin's horrid doubt has always fascinated me. With me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of a man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of lower animals, are of any value at all, if are of any value or at all trustworthy. That was a question Darwin asked towards the end of his life. You know, if this is true, how can the processes of a man's mind be trustworthy? If the survival factor is the only one that controls what we are. And David Lack's comment, this came from a book, The Unresolved Conflict. At this point, therefore, it would seem that the armies of science are in danger of destroying their own base, for the scientist must be able to trust the conclusions of his reasoning. Hence, he cannot accept the theory that man's mind has evolved wholly by natural selection. if this means, as it would appear to, that the conclusion of the mind depends ultimately on their survival value and not their truth, all scientific theories, including that of natural selection, would be untrustworthy. Or Haldane, if my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I've no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing my brain to be composed of atoms. You can go on. There's some very amusing quotations from different people. C.S. Lewis, by the way, in his book on miracles, has a couple of chapters on reasoning, which are classic. And chapters 1 to 5 in his book on miracles deal with reasoning and morality. And anybody who's interested in communicating the gospel to thinking people should read the first 5 chapters of miracles. He has such a brilliant way of communicating as well. I have several pages down in my little book here typed out from miracles, but it would take too long to read them. One point he makes is that the total system, this system, is not supposed to be rational. It's accidental. The total system is not supposed to be rational. All thoughts, whatever, are therefore the results of irrational causes, and nothing more than that. The finest piece of scientific reasoning is caused in just the same irrational way as the thoughts a man has because a bit of bone is pressing on his brain. If we continue to apply our rule, both are equally valueless. And so on. I'd like to read it all, but there's just not time. The Freudian proves that all thoughts are merely due to complexes, except the thoughts which constitute this proof itself. The Marxist proves that all thoughts result from class conditioning, except the thought he is thinking while he says this. It is therefore always impossible to begin with any other data whatever, and from them to find out whether thought is valid. You must do exactly the opposite. You must begin by admitting the self-evidence of logical thought. We are interested in man only because his rationality is the little telltale rift in nature which shows there is something beyond or behind her. That's how he concludes this long section on reasoning. And that's down at the top of page 4. We're interested in man only because his rationality is a little telltale rift in nature which shows there's something beyond or behind her. But to learn how to use this in an evangelistic situation, you have to read extensively, make some notes, get it into your own thinking patterns and forms so that you don't have to keep looking up quotations. And you don't come across as artificial. It has to be part of your thinking pattern. And reading what other people have said is a great help towards that. Now let's look at morality and meaning. And this is page 4 now of the handout. There's much more to this than we have down here. I read a book called Evolution and Ethics by Julian Huxley, and then Evolution in Action by the same man, and The Meaning of Evolution by Gaylord Simpson, both men being atheists. And their chapters on morality are tragic. Schaefer's comment as he evaluates statements such as Huxley and Simpson would come up with is here on page 4. Nobody has ever discovered a way of having real morals without a moral absolute. If there is no moral absolute, we are left with hedonism, doing what I like, or some form of social contract theory, what is best for society as a whole. However, neither of these alternatives corresponds to the moral notions that men have, nor to what men mean when they speak of morals. Without morals, without absolutes, morals as morals cease to exist. and humanistic man, starting from himself, has failed to find the absolute. But because the God of the Bible is there, real models exist. Within this framework, I can say one action is right and another wrong, without talking nonsense. The first chapter, The Mere Christianity, by C.S. Lewis, is also excellent on this, as are his early chapters in Miracles. Lewis, Miracles, page 37. Talks about the meaning of the word ought. And whenever we say we ought to do something, it suggests that we have a moral standard. If the oughts of Mr. Wells and, say, Franco are both equally the impulses which nature has conditioned each to have, and both tell us nothing about any objective right or wrong, whence all the fervour? Do they remember while they are writing that when they tell us we ought to make a better world, the words ought and better must on their own showing refer to an irrationally conditioned impulse, which cannot be true or false any more than a vomit or a yawn. The ought or right or wrong have no more meaning, Lewis points out here, than a vomit or a yawn. My idea is that sometimes they do forget. That is their glory. Holding a philosophy which excludes humanity, they yet remain human, because they're made in the image of God. Then there's meaning here. Morality and meaning are the key factors. A very interesting confession by Aldous Huxley. I had motives for not wanting the world to have a meaning, consequently assumed it had none, and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in mere metaphysics. He's also concerned to prove there's no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do, or why his friends should not seize political power and govern in the way they find most advantageous. For myself, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation, sexual and political. Or over page to page 5 by Camus. Up till now, man derived his coherence from his creator, but from the moment he consecrates his rupture with him, he finds himself delivered over to the fleeting moment, to the passing days, and to wasted sensibility. The central neurosis of our time is meaninglessness. And we can direct our approach, often very fruitfully, to the God-given and permanent quest for meaning that is there in the heart and life of every person. We'll have to stop at this point. Let me give you some... Probably most of us don't have the interest or the opportunity to read source books, and therefore mostly we were interested in reading the conclusions of other people. And here are some good books that will help us deal with thinking people. I've got them divided into three categories. Of priority in my own thinking. The first one is Runaway World.
But if someone were to say, oh, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, likewise, did he or did he not mean what he said? That I brought this up yesterday, and one of the discussion leaders said, well, when you read the Bible, either Jesus said it or he didn't say it. You can't go around...
Well, he said it, and you have to understand it at its obvious meaning. When he said the way, he didn't mean that he was made of tar and concrete and was laid down on the road. He meant that, you know, a way is a connection between two points, and I am the way, he is the connection to man and God.
What philosophy is it that says that, or religion that people are saying that Jesus simply represented or meant love, meaning not so much he, but love is the way?
Well, a lot. Many of the...
Who says that?
Well, most of them do. Most of the synchronistic Eastern religions do. Most of them say that.
How do you answer that?
Well, it's a process. You know, you don't answer that sitting down with a guy, but I've seen those guys change when they come to live with you. We almost ruined our home at one time, having too many of them living with us.
Don't you, when they go on that basis, you just go along with them and break down their conception of the perfect love, which,
yes,
according to them, couldn't exist.
And also the source of love.
Yeah.
You know, and the definition of love and the source of love.
Naturally, you can break them down to where perfect love does not exist in man. So where does perfect love? You know, they've got this word for perfect love, but it doesn't exist. You know, and then you get them finally, you know, down to the roots.
And often it has no content. It's a word they use without content. So you know, what do they mean by it? We do live in a complicated world, you know. But questions are being asked that haven't been asked. You know, at least some of them haven't been asked before.
We evolved from monkeys. Why do we still have monkeys?
No evolutionist has ever suggested that. No one's, as far as I know, has ever suggested that.
Why do you mean that our ancestors weren't a family?
Well, yeah, but there is some sort of family connection. We're not descended from them. And physically, we are extremely alike.
Maybe no one's ever suggested that.
Well, no evolutionist has ever suggested we descended from monkeys.
What was the suggestion?
That, you know, way back there was a parent stock that deviated. But, you know, that's hard to think of. But, you have no option but to believe Genesis 1. To disbelieve Genesis 1 is to disbelieve in the authority of Christ, who stamped all of Scripture with his authority.
Genesis 1, though, doesn't really come out against an evolution, I don't
evolution
believe.
Evolution in Genesis 1, a lot follow the same pattern.
Well, there are significant differences as well.
Are you talking about the genealogies that are written out, and it appears by the genealogies that man has only been here for, what, 4,000
years? Oh, there's too many gaps. There are gaps in the genealogies. There's just significant family heads listed in them, so that's not a problem.
Well, then what is the problem? I don't see it. I am in perfect peace about evolution.
Yeah, I think that's one of our friends that we have in Columbia. That's keeping him from really coming to Christ. His right to face is evolution, and he's a biology major.
Well, the point is that evolution can account for none of the things that we were speaking about today.
Yeah, that's true.
It cannot. No evolutionist has ever, as they've tried to, they've failed abysmally.
Well, that evolution is sort of like a conditioning process, and there'd be no conditioning to result in love or reason.
Or morality, or personality, or... you know, if the world had no meaning, how would we know it had no meaning?
You can count for consciousness.
Well, yes.
Consciousness follows a meaning, though.
But meaning is a different thing. But if you talk to people with an evolutionary background, you see, they know that it can't count for those things. Hence, well, you're talking on ground that... that is prepared.
What I was wondering about is how do you actually handle your philosophy people, though? You know, your people that are really I'm thinking of a specific person from where I come from, of course, you know, there's always that guy,
yeah.
And his two younger brothers are Christians, and they really have struggled when he comes home from school. He hassles everybody in the whole community, and they're not up to him, and they keep wanting to sit myself on. I don't even want to have a contest. It hasn't happened yet. And in great fear, when I returned from the conference, though, I'm going to run into him.
Yeah, the boy's that guy, and
he is sharp. That's his. I mean, he's going for, you know, he's on his doctorate now, and his original bachelor's, I think, was in philosophy. He's doing some other area now. He has enough background where it's a very rough case.
Maybe he needs to, when you're dealing with a specialist problem, you need to get a specialist answer. And if he would even be open enough to read a book by a guy who came out of the same background.
You see, and the other thing I'm running into is, see, there's two guys I'm thinking of. There's another guy who's not as well educated. He accepts it because it allows him to do what he wants to do.
Yeah, well, like Huxley, yeah.
But then that's the thing I'm running into with both of them, you know. The idea that they want to build a man.
Well, you can nail that one, isn't it? So, maybe he considers that a valid reason, but it's not an intellectual problem. It's a moral unwillingness. Mm-hmm. That guy's not faced with an intellectual difficulty keeping him from turning to Christ, but a moral unwillingness which keeps him from examining the evidence. I even say that to a guy. There's something there that's keeping you from examining the evidence. Well, that can't be any intellectual thing, because pure intellect would want to examine any evidence. Therefore, it's a moral thing.
One more thing. What do you do when you come up against a situation that at the moment you're not equipped for? Because I had one view of this when I was first going, and I had a Bible in my books at school, and a guy, he really gave me this positive thing, and he's and he really felt sorry for me. I believe this stuff that was going to cause my life to be utterly worthless and such things. And he felt like, he really thought he was doing me a favor by explaining this stuff to me. And he says, do you have a Bible? And I'm like, I guess. And he takes it and he proceeds to show me in his own mind where the scriptures are contradictory. Now, I finally got home, got away from this nut, and got my Bible out. And praise to God, Holy Spirit, I was able to get squared away. But at the time, I just had to say, well, I can't show you where you're wrong.
But there's also, just the fact of your own testimony that Christ has changed your life, these things are as valid witnessing.
Mm-hmm. What do you do, though, to make it to a point where you have...
Well, we always are hitting those points, so we're never going to become expert in everything. Mm-hmm. So right to the end of our lives, we're going to be meeting people like that. Therefore, we have to have resources available. We either have to know people who are experts in that area, who we can introduce them to, because as we become their friends, they're usually open to that, or we have to have literature that we can use. I don't think there's any other way. But to try and do it is only to expose your own inadequacy.
What would you say to this guy? This guy out there, I don't know the answers.
Well, the truth of Christianity isn't dependent on those answers. It's dependent on the fact that 2,000 years ago, Jesus was crucified and rose from the dead.
I get really upset with the guy, and I start going off on an emotional slant, and I really catch myself up, and these guys, as soon as you start going emotional, they've got you where they want you. More or less, that's what they expect from them. I'm an emotional person. So how can you leave the situation and still leave the upper hand?
Well, I'm not sure that always you have to leave the upper hand, but humility is involved, and there's nothing intrinsically wrong in admitting that you're asking questions that this point of time don't have an answer to, but then that's not what my faith depends on. It depends on the fact that Jesus, in history, died on the cross and rose from the dead.